Chapter 23 of the Autobiography of Rudolf Steiner, entitled Chapters in the Course of My Life, 1861 to 1907. I first traveled to Germany in 1889. I was invited to collaborate on the Weimar edition of Goethe's works, which the Grand Duchess Sophie of Saxony had entrusted to the Goethe archives. Goethe's literary estate had been bequeathed to her by Goethe's grandson, Walter von Goethe, who had died a few years earlier. The Grand Duchess established the Goethe archives, and along with several Goethean experts, mainly Hermann Grimm, Gustav von Lepper, and Wilhelm Scherer, decided to issue an edition of Goethe's works that would combine the published writings with unpublished material from the literary estate. My contribution to the published Goethe literature led to an invitation to prepare part of Goethe's natural scientific writings for the Weimar edition. I was called to Weimar to orient myself in the scientific section of that legacy and to take the first steps toward the necessary work. I stayed several weeks in the quote-unquote Goethe city, and it was a festive time in my life. I had occupied myself for years with Goethe's ideas. Now I was able to be in the places where these ideas had originated. I spent my weeks there with that uplifting feeling. Every day I was privileged to have before my eyes papers that supplemented the manuscripts I had worked with earlier in relation to the Goethe edition for Kirchner's National Literature. My work with the Kirchner edition provided me with an image of Goethe's worldview in my soul. Now it was a matter of discovering how this picture could endure in light of the unpublished material on natural science in the Goethe estate. I began with eager anticipation to work my way into this aspect of the legacy. I was soon confident that the unpublished material contained additional important contributions that would lead, in particular, to a more exact understanding of Goethe's way of thinking. In my writings thus far, I had interpreted his way of thinking by showing how, in Goethe's view, ordinary human consciousness is initially far from the true nature of the surrounding world. In turn, out of this very standing at a distance, sprouts the impulse to develop within the soul, prior to knowing the world, powers of cognition not present in ordinary consciousness. From this perspective, it was very significant to me to find statements such as these among Goethe's papers. Quote, "To find a certain relationship to these various ways," Goethe meant various ways of human knowing and their relationship to the outer world, "let us classify them in relation to knowledge as the utilitarian, the knowers, the perceptive, and the comprehensive. 1. Utilitarians demand that knowledge should be useful, and are the first to define the field of knowledge and comprehend what is practical. They gain confidence through experience and require a certain breadth of knowledge. 2. Knowers crave information. They require a calm, impartial view and have a restless curiosity and clear intellect. They maintain a relationship to these qualities and approach scientifically only what has already been established. 3. Those who are perceptive are productive in their activity to begin with. Cognition, as it increases, needs imagination without knowing this, and indeed bypasses it, moving on to perception, no matter how much those who adhere to information, quote, cross themselves, unquote, against imagination. They must, even before they realize it, call upon the productive forces of imagination. 4. Those who seek all-around knowledge could, in a prideful sense, be called creative. They act productively in the highest sense. Because they begin with the idea, they immediately express the unity of the whole. After that, it is the quote-unquote business of nature itself to conform to the idea." End quotes. Such remarks make it clear that Goethe views the human being in terms of ordinary consciousness as outside the essence of the external world. If, in cognition, we were to unite with that essence, we must enter a different form of consciousness. While I was in Weimar, certain questions became more and more insistent. How can we build upon the foundation of knowledge laid out by Goethe to lead, through thinking, from his view to a view that includes a spiritual experience such as I had encountered? Goethe began with what can be attained through lower stages of knowledge, the utilitarians and the knowers. He supplemented and illuminated this through the productive forces of the soul, using all that could enlighten it from the perceptive and comprehensive levels. Once he had the lower knowledge in the soul, in the light of higher contemplation and comprehension, he felt united with the essence of things. This suggests the path from one side that results from experiencing the relationship between the human being and the outer world, but it is not yet knowing the experience of the spirit. I realized that satisfaction could come only on the path from the other side, resulting from the relationship between human beings and their individual being. When the human consciousness becomes productive, that is, when it produces something from itself that adds to its initial images of reality, can consciousness remain with reality, or does it drift off and get lost in unreality? The answer requires that we understand what confronts consciousness as its own product, in quotes. It is extremely important for human consciousness to comprehend itself. One would then be able to justify experiences that are purely spiritual. As I sat over Goethe's papers in Weimar, my thoughts took these paths, repeating with increased clarity their earlier forms. It was summer. Little could be noticed of Weimar's contemporary artistic life. One could surrender peacefully to the artistic elements that were present, as though a memorial to Goethe. The present vanished. One felt transported back to the Goethe era. The present was the Liszt era, but its representatives were not present. After work, I spent time with others engaged at the archives. Also, there were collaborators who came from elsewhere for visits of various duration to the archives. Bernard Suffan, the director of the Goethe archives, received me with exceptional kindness. Julius Valla, who was a permanent co-worker, also became a dear friend. Yet none of this assumed a definite form until I returned a year later to work in the archives for a longer period. I will speak of this when I describe that period of my life. I yearned most of all to become personally acquainted with Edward von Hartmann, with whom I had been corresponding for years about philosophical matters. I was to meet him during a short stay in Berlin after my visit to Weimar. I was privileged to have a long conversation with the philosopher. He sat with his upper body upright and his legs stretched out on a sofa. He spent most of his life after a knee ailment in this position. His forehead gave the impression of a clear, acute intellect, and his eyes showed a deeply felt confidence in his understanding. His face was framed by an enormous beard. He spoke with a positive assurance that indicated how he had cast several essential thoughts over the whole world view and thus illumined it. But these very thoughts also smothered with instant criticism everything presented from a different point of view. So I sat facing him while he judged me sharply, but he really did not listen inwardly to what I said. It was his opinion that the real being of things exists in the unconscious and must remain hidden forever to human consciousness. For me, on the other hand, anything unconscious can be lifted increasingly into consciousness through the soul's inner effort. During our conversation, it occurred to me to say that we really should not assume that our mental pictures are separated from reality and merely represent something without reality. This view cannot possibly be used as a starting point for a theory of knowledge. Indeed, such an assumption blocks the way to all reality, because one could believe only that we live in mental images, and thus approach reality only in hypotheses built on the basis of those mental pictures, that is, in an unreal way. Rather, one must assess whether the mental picture is valid or arises from a preconceived notion. Edward von Hartmann responded that this point was not in dispute and that it was obvious from the very definition of the term mental pictures that they contain no reality. When I heard this response, I got a chill and shivered in my soul. To define terms as a serious point of departure for a view of life, I realized how far my outlook was from contemporary philosophy. As I sat in the train and continued my journey, I thought about that visit, which had nevertheless been so valuable to me, and I again felt an inner chill. It affected me for a long time. The end of chapter 23. Chapter 24. Except for my visit with Edward von Hartmann, The brief stops I was able to make in Berlin and Munich and on my journey through Germany after Weimar were devoted to the arts available in those places. At the time I felt my horizon broadening in this respect, and it was especially enriching for my soul life. Thus my first long journey had far-reaching significance for my views of art. A wealth of impressions lived in me as I went to Salzkammergut, where I stayed for several weeks with a family whose sons I had taught for many years. I again had to work as a private tutor, and I wanted to continue this work, because it was my goal to help develop to a certain point the boy whose education had been entrusted to me for years, and whose completely asleep soul I had been able to awaken. After I returned to Vienna, I was able to meet frequently with a group of people centered around a woman whose mystical, theosophical disposition of soul had left a deep impression on the members of the group. The hours I was privileged to spend in the home of this lady, Marie Lang, were extremely valuable to me. Marie Lang's earnest view and feeling for life was expressed with nobility and beauty in her words. In melodious, impressive language, she expressed very deep soul experiences. A life of difficult inner struggles with herself and with the world could find resolution, though incomplete, only through mystical seeking. Thus it was only natural that she was the soul of a group of seekers. Theosophy, inaugurated by H.P. Blavatsky at the end of the 19th century, had penetrated this group. Franz Hartmann, who had become widely known for his many theosophical works and his relationship to H.P. Blavatsky, had also brought his theosophy into this group. Marie Lang was largely accepting of this. The meaning she found in it seemed to match her soul quality in many ways. Yet what she received in this sense came only from outside. Within herself she had a store of mystical knowledge that life's difficult trials had made conscious in a completely elemental way. The architects, writers, and others I met at Marie Lang's could hardly have been interested in the theosophy of Franz Hartmann if Marie Lang herself had not participated in it. And I certainly would not have become interested. The whole attitude to the spiritual world presented in the writings of Franz Hartmann was in direct opposition to my own. I could not credit it with inner truthfulness. I was less interested in its content than in how it affected those who were, after all, truly seeking souls. Through Marie Lang I met Rosa Mayreder, who was one of her friends. Rosa Mayreder is one of those whom I have always held in great esteem, and whose development I have followed with deep interest. It is easy to imagine that what I have to say would not particularly please her. Nevertheless, it expresses my feelings about what entered my life through her. At the time, none of her writings had yet been published. Later, they rightly made a deep impression upon many, and have no doubt given her a prominent position in literature. But what revealed itself in those writings was alive in Rosa Mayreder in a spiritual form of expression, one to which I had to turn with the very strongest sympathy. She impressed me as having every soul endowment to such an extent that in her harmonious interaction they formed a proper expression of the truly human. She combined her numerous artistic gifts with a free, penetrating sense of observation. Her paintings revealed her inner development as well as her devoted deepening in the objective world. The stories she published at the beginning of her literary career demonstrate a perfect harmony between personal struggling and entirely objective consideration. In the works that followed, this characteristic became ever more striking. It reached a peak in a later work published in two volumes titled Critique of Femininity. I believe it benefited my life greatly to have spent, at the time I am describing, so much time in the company of Rosa Mayreder during her years of seeking and soul struggles. Again, I look back to a relationship that rose above the intellect and developed an intensive life, in a certain sense completely independent of it. For my worldview, and even more the direction of my feelings, were not those of Rosa Mayreder. The way I rise to experience the spiritual from contemporary accepted science could not possibly appeal to her. On the basis of science, she tries to develop ideas that permit the full development of the human personality, without allowing knowledge of a purely spiritual world any role in that development. Consequently, what for me is absolutely necessity in this direction is meaningless to her. She is completely absorbed in the demands of the immediate human individual and ignores the spiritual forces active within the individual. According to this approach, she has produced the most significant exposition to date on the nature and life needs of women. Nor did Rosa Mayreder find my relationship to art in any way satisfactory. In her opinion, I misunderstood the essence of art, whereas I, in fact, worked to comprehend the true element of art through my inner experience of spirit. She thought I failed to penetrate sufficiently the revelations of the physical world, and that, as a result, I did not reach the true nature of art, but, in fact, I worked at getting to the very essence of sensory perceptible form. None of that altered my deep, friendly interest in Rosa Mayreder, which was kindled at a time when I owed to her some of the most worthwhile hours of my life, and indeed my interest has not diminished to this day. Often I had the privilege of participating in conversations at Rosa Mayreder's home, where profound people gathered. Her close friend Hugo Wolf would sit there silently, seemingly more absorbed in deep introspection than listening to what went on around him. But though he said little, one listened to him in the soul. What he experienced would communicate itself mysteriously to those gathered with him. I was very deeply attached and endeared to Rosa Mayreder's husband, Karl Mayreder, a fine human being and artist. This was also true of his brother, Julius Mayreder, an art enthusiast. Marie Lang and her group of friends were often there, and so was Friedrich Eckstein, who at that time stood completely within the spiritual stream and the theosophical worldview. During this time, my title, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, a Philosophy of Freedom, assumed an increasingly definite form in my soul. While the book took shape, I spoke of it mainly to Rosa Mayreder. She relieved some of the inner loneliness I experienced. She worked toward a concept of the immediately present human personality, and I toward the world revelation that this personality can find within the foundation of soul through the opening spirit eye. There were many bridges between these two goals, and often in later life I have recalled with gratitude this or that experience. For example, a walk through the wonderful alpine forests during which Rosa Mayreder and I discussed the true meaning of human freedom. The end of chapter 24. Part 2, Fertile Ground, Weimar, 1890 to 1897. Chapter 25. Looking back on my life, the first 3 decades appear as a self-contained chapter. At the end of that period, I moved to Weimar to work for nearly 7 years in the Goethe-Schiller archives. My time spent in Vienna between the trip to Weimar, already described, and actually settling in Goethe City, I view as a time when all I had inwardly worked toward until then reached a certain conclusion. The efforts toward the title, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, lived on from that conclusion. The ideas I used to express my views were substantially related to the fact that to me the sensory world was not true reality as such. In the articles and essays I published during that period, I constantly stressed that the human soul manifests as a true reality when engaged not in thinking drawn from the sensory world, but in the free activity of thinking that goes beyond sensory perceptions. I presented such sense-free thinking as what the human soul utilizes to stand within the spiritual being of the world. But I strongly asserted that while living in such sense-free thinking, human beings in fact find themselves consciously within the spiritual foundations of existence. To me it made no sense to speak about limits of knowledge. To know was to rediscover the spiritual meaning experienced through the soul in the perceived world. Speaking of any limit to knowledge seemed to me a confession that true reality is not experienced spiritually in the soul, and consequently is unavailable to being rediscovered in the world perceived externally. My primary concern in bringing forth my own insights was to refute the theory that there are limits to knowledge. I wanted to reject the path of knowledge that looks at the sensory world and then wants to go outward through the sensory world to break through to true reality. I wanted to show that true reality must be sought by going more deeply into the inner human being, not by attempting to break through toward the outer. Those who want to break through toward the outer and then find it cannot be done speak of limits of knowledge. It is not that it cannot be done because the human capacity for knowledge is limited, but because one is looking for the impossible, as is shown by proper self-reflection. by attempting to penetrate further into the sensory world, merely continues the physical, so to speak, behind the sensory. It is as though someone living in illusion attempted to find the cause of the illusion in more illusions. The sense of my presentation is this. Human beings confront the world with the power of cognition, which they develop in earthly life from birth on. First, they gain a concept of the physical realm, but this is merely an outpost of knowing. This ideation does not yet reveal everything contained in the world. The world has an inner living reality, but human beings do not immediately reach that living reality, remaining closed to it. Because they have not yet faced the world with their own being, they form a picture of the world without being. The world image they form is in fact an illusion. When we experience the world through our senses, we see an illusion. But when we add thinking that is free of the senses, from our own inner being, to sense perception, illusion is permeated with reality and ceases to be illusion. The human spirit then experiences itself within us and meets the spirit in the world, which is no longer hidden behind the physical world, but weaves and lives within it. I thought that discovering the spirit in the world was not a matter of logical reasoning or a continuation of physical perception, but that it comes about when we move from sense perception to the experience of sense-free thinking. In 1888, I wrote for the second volume of my edition of Goethe's Natural Scientific Writings. It is permeated entirely with these views. Quote, "If one grants to thinking an ability to perceive beyond the senses, one must also acknowledge that the objects exist beyond physical reality. Those objects, however, are the ideas. As soon as thinking takes hold of an idea, it merges with a primordial foundation of existence. What has effect outwardly enters the human spirit. The human being becomes one with objective reality in its highest potency. Becoming aware of the idea within the reality is the true communion of the human being. Thinking has the same relationship to ideas that the eye has to light and the ear to sound. It is the organ for apprehending." End quote. At that time, it was really my intention to show that the being in the sensory world is spirit, rather than to describe the spiritual world as it appears when sense-free thinking goes beyond the experience of itself to perceive spirit. My intention was to state that nature is in fact spiritual. This was because destiny led me to wrestle with contemporary epistemological theories. They assume that nature is void of spirit, and thus see a need to demonstrate the extent to which human beings are justified in formulating in their spirit a spiritual image of nature. I wanted to use a very different theory of knowledge in order to oppose that view. It was my intention to show that in thinking one does not form images about the world, as though outside it, but that cognizing is experience. In the act of knowing, one is within the being of things. Furthermore, destiny also led me to connect my own views with those of Goethe. This gave me ample opportunity to demonstrate that the external world is spiritual. Goethe himself worked toward a worldview that acknowledges spirit, but his views offered no opportunity to speak in a similar way about the purely spiritual world as such. Goethe had not developed his spiritual view of nature as far as viewing spirit directly. I was also concerned with expressing the idea of freedom. When we react to instincts, urges, passions, and so on, we are not free. Impulses then become conscious in us, just as sensory impressions do, and determine our actions. This is not the true self acting, but action on a level where the true self does not reveal itself at all. We no more disclose ourselves as human beings through such actions than the physical world reveals its being through mere sensory observation. The sensory world is not really illusory, but the human being makes it so. As human beings, we can also make urges, cravings, and so on, which resemble sensory impressions, just as substantial as illusions through our actions. In this way, we allow illusion rather than we ourselves to act within us. We allow an act without spirit. Your spirit acts once you find an impulse to action that is a moral intuition in the realm of sense-free thinking. then you act, and not otherwise. One is then a free being, acting from the true self. I wanted to show that no one can understand freedom who dismisses sense-free thinking as a purely spiritual aspect of the human being, and that freedom is immediately comprehensible once the reality of sense-free thinking is understood. Again, in relation to the concept of freedom, it was not so much my concern to describe a purely spiritual world, where we experience moral intuitions, but more to emphasize the spiritual character of these intuitions themselves. If they had been my primary concern, I would have begun this way in the chapter Moral Imagination, in title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, a Philosophy of Freedom. Quote, "Free spirits act out of their impulses, that is, from intuitions experienced outside of physical existence in a purely spiritual world beyond the awareness of ordinary consciousness." End quote. But at the time I was concerned only with characterizing the purely spiritual nature of moral intuitions. Consequently, I indicated their existence within the totality of the human world of ideas and said, quote, "Free spirits act out of their impulses, that is, from intuitions chosen by thinking from the totality of their world of ideas," page 180, end quote. One does not look to a purely spiritual world, and could not write that first sentence. One who does not look to a purely spiritual world and could not write that first sentence would also be unable to fully claim the second. But there are plenty of passages entitled Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path that point to the first sentence. For example, quote, "The highest stage of individual life is conceptual thinking without reference to a specific perceptual content. We determine the content of our concept out of the conceptual sphere through pure intuition. Such a concept initially contains no reference to specific percepts." End quote. That was on page 143. This refers to sensory perceptions. If at the time I had intended to describe the spiritual world and not merely the spiritual nature of moral intuitions, I would have considered the contrast between physical and spiritual perceptions. But my only concern was to emphasize the non-physical nature of moral intuitions. This was the orientation of my world of ideas in my 30th year, as the first chapter of my life came to an end, and I left Vienna for Weimar. The end of chapter 25. Chapter 26. As the first chapter of my life came to an end, I felt an inner need to become clear about certain orientations of the human soul. One such orientation was mysticism. I found, through my specified disposition, that it was difficult to find any relationship to mysticism as it appeared to my soul's eye through the various eras of human spiritual development, Eastern wisdom, Neoplatonism, Christianity during the Middle Ages, and Kabbalism. It seemed to me that the mystics failed to come to terms with the world of ideas in which to me the spirit manifests. There seemed to be no real spirituality in a desire for inner fulfillment that plunges the life of ideas into a soul life that is void of ideas. In such a path I could not see a pathway to the light, but only to spiritual darkness. To run from ideas in an attempt to attain spiritual reality seemed like a deficiency in cognition, because even though spiritual reality does not actually weave within them directly, it is only through ideas that one can experience such a reality. Nevertheless, I was drawn to one aspect of mystical endeavor, the nature of inner mystical experience. Mystics wish to unite inwardly with the source of human existence, not merely theorize about it as though it were an external thing. I saw clearly, however, that the same quality of inner experience can be attained by plunging into the soul's depths accompanied by the full, clear content of ideas, rather than by stripping off that content through meditation. I wanted to carry the light of the idea realm into the warmth of the inner experience. Mystics seemed to be those who cannot see spirit in ideas and are thus inwardly chilled by ideas. The coldness that mystics experience in ideas causes them to try to warm the soul by escaping ideas. I experienced just the opposite. Warmth flooded my inner life as I formulated my initially indefinite experience of the spiritual world into clearly defined ideas. Often I thought of how the mystics completely failed to grasp the warmth and intimacy of soul experienced by uniting inwardly with ideas permeated by spirit. To me, this union had always been like a personal association with the spiritual world. Mysticism seemed to strengthen rather than weaken the position of a materialistically inclined observation of nature. Materialists reject the spiritual world either because they do not recognize its existence or because they view human knowledge as suitable only to what is sensory perceptible. Where the senses reach their limit, materialists set up the boundary of knowledge. A typical mystic and a materialist have the same concepts of human knowledge gained through ideas. Mystics maintain that ideas do not reach spirit, and consequently human knowledge gained through ideas always leaves one outside the spiritual realm. Since mystics still want to attain the spirit, they turn toward inner experience empty of ideas. Consequently, they agree with materialists that knowledge gained through ideas is limited to what is physical. To enter the inner being of soul without ideas is to enter a realm of feeling only. Then one would say that what we usually mean by a path of knowledge cannot lead to the spirit, that to reach spirit one must leave the sphere of knowledge and immerse oneself in that of feeling. And materialists can agree with a view such as this, as long as they do not view everything said about spirit as meaningless, fantastic wordplay. They consider ideas about physical phenomena to be the only justifiable basis for knowledge, and consider a mystical relationship to spirit to be entirely personal. It is thought to be something one may or may not be inclined toward, depending on one's disposition, and it is certainly something that cannot be spoken about as one does of sound knowledge. It is their view that the human relationship to spirit is all a matter of subjective feeling. The forces in my soul opposed mysticism with even greater strength as I placed this before my soul's vision. To me, perception of spirit within the soul was far more credible than what we perceive with the senses. To place limits on knowledge, despite such soul experience, was impossible for me. I resolutely rejected the path to spirit based only on feeling. Nevertheless, I still sensed a remote kinship to my own relationship to the spiritual realm in the nature of mystical experiences. I sought union with the spirit through ideas irradiated by spirit, just as the mystic sought union with something void of ideas. I could also say that my spiritual perception was based on a mystical experience of ideas. It was not very difficult for me to become clear and overcome this inner conflict. True perception of spirit illuminates the valid range of ideas and defines the proper limits of what is personal. Any observer of the spiritual realm knows that the personal is no longer effective once soul being becomes an organ for perceiving spirit. The real difficulty was to find ways to express my inner perceptions in my writings. It is impossible to find new ways immediately for expressing observations unfamiliar to the reader. I could use the usual formulations used in the field of natural observation, or I could use those of mystical writers, which seemed to be accompanied by insurmountable difficulties. I concluded that scientific forms of expression have a rich meaning, even though its meaning is conceived of materialistically. I tried to formulate ideas that would indicate spirit, just as scientific ideas indicate the material. This would enable me to retain the character of the idea I wanted to convey, which seemed impossible with mystical formulations, which do not indicate an objective reality beyond the human, but describe only subjective experiences in the human. I wanted to avoid describing human experiences and show how a spiritual world is revealed through spiritual organs of perception within the human being. From these foundations, the ideas formed that led to my title, Intuitive Thinking is a Spiritual Path, a Philosophy of Freedom. When I formulated these ideas, I did not want a mystical impulse to rule me, but it was clear that the ultimate experience of what needed to be revealed through ideas must bear the same character in the essence of the soul as it does in the inner perception of the mystic. Nevertheless, there is still a difference. On the path I describe, human beings surrender themselves and express the outer spiritual world objectively within themselves, whereas mystics enhance the life of their own inner being, thus extinguishing the true form of objective spirit. The end of chapter 26. Chapter 27. It took me a long time to present Goethe's scientific ideas in the introduction to Kirchner's German national literature. I had begun in the early 80s and had not completed it when I moved from Vienna to Weimar to begin the second chapter of my life. This was because of the difficulty I described in relation to scientific and mystical forms of expression. While I was looking for the proper conceptual form to express Goethe's stance in relation to natural science, I also had to make headway in conceptualizing my own spiritual experiences as I contemplated natural processes. As a result, I was pushed continually from Goethe toward presenting my own worldview, and then back again, so that I could better interpret his thoughts through my own. I felt that the essential aspect of Goethe's approach was his rejection of merely theoretical, easily surveyable thought in the face of knowing the boundless wealth of living reality. Goethe becomes rationalistic when describing the manifold forms of plants and animals. In order to understand meteorological phenomena or the geological structure of the earth, he tried to find ideas that manifest the activity of nature's becoming. But his ideas were not abstract. They were images that lived in his soul like thoughts. When I considered what Goethe presented as such images in his natural scientific works, I was faced with something that satisfied me deep in my soul. I believed that I could see nature's processes as reflected in the human spirit, accurately represented in the content of those idea images, if they were developed further. It was clear to me that the predominant thinking in modern science must be elevated to this Goethean way of thinking. However, in view of Goethe's understanding of nature, how were his idea images related to spiritual reality itself? The idea images are valid only when they point to just such a spiritual reality behind the physical world. But in his awe before the boundless riches of reality, Goethe refrains from trying to describe the spiritual world once he has brought the sensory realm into his soul in the form of images in keeping with spirit. Thus I had to show that although Goethe could indeed live inwardly by advancing from knowledge of the physical to that of the spiritual, no one else could fully understand Goethe's soul life without going farther than he did, taking cognition to the degree that the ideas led to a concept of the spiritual world itself. Goethe was within the spirit as he spoke of nature. He was afraid of becoming abstract if he went from lively participation in the spirit to a life of thoughts about being within it. He wanted to sense himself within spirit, but did not want to think himself within spirit. I often felt untrue to Goethe's way of thinking and presenting thoughts about his view of the world. In nearly every detail I had to interpret concerning Goethe's view, I had to master ever again the method of speaking about Goethe in Goethe's own way. Through my own thinking, I struggled for a year to present Goethe's ideas by continually developing a better understanding of him. Looking back, I realize that I owe much to that struggle for the development of my spiritual experiences of cognition. Because my destiny brought me the Goethe task as part of my life, this development was slowed considerably. Otherwise, I would have pursued my spiritual experiences and described them exactly as they presented themselves to me. My consciousness would have widened into the spiritual world more rapidly, but I would have felt no need to work hard at penetrating my inner being. Thus the Goethe task led me to experience the difference between a soul state in which the spiritual world reveals itself by grace, and one in which step by step the soul develops an affinity with the spirit in order to stand within the spiritual of the world once it has experienced itself as spirit. Only in this actual participation does one experience how intimately the human spirit and the world's spirituality can grow together in the human soul. While I worked to interpret Goethe, he was always beside me in spirit, admonishing and continually reminding me that one who rushes too quickly along the spiritual path may attain a circumscribed experience of spirit, but leaves behind the fullness of life, poor in the substance of reality. Because of my connection with the Goethe work, I was able to observe vividly, quote, how karma works in human life, unquote. There are two aspects of destiny that become unified in one's life. One arises from the soul's longing and is directed toward the outer world. The other comes toward a person from the outside world. My own soul impulse was directed toward conscious experience of the spirit, and the external world's spiritual life brought me the Goethe task. I had to harmonize these two streams in my consciousness. The last years of the first period of my life were spent alternately justifying myself in my own eyes and then in Goethe's eyes. In my doctoral dissertation, the task I assumed was experienced inwardly, that is, to bring about, quote, self-comprehension of the human consciousness, unquote. I realized that we can understand the truth of the outer world only by seeing that true reality within our self. The meeting between the reality of the outer world and the reality of the soul must, for cognizing consciousness, be accomplished through tireless inner activity of spirit. This is always present when one becomes aware of the freedom of one's will and action. Freedom lives as an objective fact in unbiased consciousness. Nevertheless, it becomes a mystery to human understanding, because initially we have not given self-awareness to our own true being, but achieve it only after conscious self-comprehension. Only after appropriate preparation can freedom, the human being's greatest treasure, be understood. My title, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, is based on an experience of self-comprehending human consciousness. Freedom is practiced in the will. Freedom is experienced in feeling. Freedom is recognized in thinking. But to accomplish this, the life in thinking must not be lost. As I worked on title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, in presenting my thoughts, I was constantly concerned with keeping my inner experience fully awake, even in the thoughts themselves. This gives thoughts the mystical nature of inner sight, but it also makes such sight resemble physical sight. When you work through to this inner experience, you see no contradiction between knowing nature and knowing spirit. It becomes clear that knowing spirit is simply a transformed continuation of knowing nature. Because this seemed true to me, later on the title page of title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, I wrote, quote, results of introspective observations in accord with natural scientific method, unquote. If the method of natural science is faithfully adhered to in relation to spirit, it leads to cognition in this area as well. The end of chapter 27 and the end of this section of the reading.